Hi, everybody. I'm Ruth. I'm administrative assistant at the Couples Institute, and I'm late today, and you all have my apologies. Michelle, may I introduce you?
Sure. Thank you.
Okay. Michelle Wangler-Joy, MFT, has been with the Couples Institute since 2002. Wow. And is currently a therapist on our staff. She leads Marriage Prep 101 workshops to engaged and newlywed couples with her husband, and she also teaches communication workshops to all couples. In addition to teaching advanced classes to therapists, Michelle has been a local and national speaker for professional organizations, including PESI, on how to help more couples. She's a certified Enneagram teacher, and she loves incorporating the Enneagram in helping the couples that she works with. I have known Michelle for only 2 years, and in that time, I have learned how much she cares about the work that she does and how much she cares about helping couples. So I think this will be a very productive session for everybody. And Michelle, it's up to you now.
Okay. Thanks so much, Ruth. And hi, everybody, again. Just a little bit of an introduction. I discovered the Enneagram over 20 years ago. And when I did, it felt like somebody was just reading my soul. You know, I couldn't believe how closely the authors of the book I was reading were able to articulate my experience in life. And it just really changed me. I know that there's a lot of personality classification systems out there, but the reason I like the Enneagram so much is it just really clicked with me. But out of all of them that I've come across after all these years, it's helped me the most to understand myself in new ways. It's helped me to understand people I'm in relationship with and helps me in my work with couples, definitely. So knowing the system, you know, it gives me options that I didn't have before. There's a freedom that comes with that. And what I mean by that when I say that is I'm sure that, you know, you've all had a client or been in a relationship with someone that you might describe as having contradictory behavior, or they're controlling, or they're judgmental, or they're too sensitive, too self-centered, too pushy, too bossy. And we especially hear our couples describe their partner with some of these words. And it can be really frustrating and a real challenge in terms of how to respond when we're with a partner that we might describe that way, or even sitting in the room when a partner describes their partner that way. And we may not, if we're in relationship with somebody like that, we may not always respond from our higher self when we come up against those qualities. So for me, knowing the Enneagram has helped me to understand people better so that I can have more compassion, more understanding about where they're coming from, what's going on for them beneath the surface. And that really enables me to respond more from my higher self when I'm around challenging behaviors, because I feel like I can understand what's going on, kind of rise above it and say, okay, I think, you know, here's what's being activated in that person perhaps. And that makes me overall feel better about myself as well and how I respond. So I can have an idea about the pain people are grappling with, what's coming up for them, what they're stuck in, what's their internal conflict in terms of their Enneagram style. It helps me see people's humanness and gives me a clue as to how to speak their language, which I try to do if I am working with a couple or even with an individual in therapy and I know their Enneagram type. I can really use their language, which helps with rapport, and that really helps the couple feel a lot more like I get them. So in terms of structuring today's call, what I'm going to do is start by kind of giving you a big picture of the Enneagram, some things to keep in mind, just in case you're totally new to it. And I said this earlier before we started the call, but if you're totally new to the Enneagram, you've come to the right place. And also, if you know the Enneagram and you'd like to begin using it a little bit more with your couples, you've also come to the right phone call here. So I'll describe some things to keep in mind about it, give you the big picture, and then I'm going to describe the 9 types and how they show up in couples therapy. Now, this is important for me to say this, which is I'm not teaching this in kind of a black and white way, which is I'm not saying if you have a type 1 coming in for therapy, here's what you're going to always see kind of thing. But it's more from a place of when I'm working with this type, here's a few patterns that I've seen show up more often than not, and here tends to be the kind of work that I do with a person who comes in of this type. So I have a challenge for today, too, with this call, because I'm really teaching something that could be taught over a weekend, and I'm doing it within an hour. So this is really designed, though, to give you a basic overview and to help get you started in beginning to use this with your couples. And I'm going to talk all the way to the top of the hour, and then I'm going to stop at that point for any questions that you have. So the way the Enneagram is set up is there's 9 types or classifications or personality types, whatever you want to call it, and they're numbered 1 through 9 in no random order. And what I mean when I say no random order is that no type is more superior or better than the other. They're all equal. And the theory with this system is that each of us has one dominant type or a home base. And each type brings its own challenges with that, and each type has its own strengths. And so I'm going to be talking about that as I go through each of the types with you today. Each personality type has a core belief. And what I mean when I say core belief about life is something like, in order for me to be loved or valued or get through life in a productive way, I must blank. And that fill-in-the-blank is different for each of these 9 types. And then whatever that fill-in-the-blank is, we tend to organize our decisions. We tend to make sense of things around that core belief. So as I said, having the core belief leads us to develop some strengths in us, but it also limits us and can cause us to run into the same wall over and over, because it's almost like we're seeing the world through one lens when there's actually more than one lens to filter our thoughts through, so that it can stint our personal growth from that sense. Sometimes when I introduce the Enneagram to people or to my couples, most of them are open to it. Most of them are curious about it. When I introduce it to them, people seem to be eager to learn more about themselves and learn more about their partner. But on occasion, I run into people that say, I don't like being put in a box, or I don't like you labeling me as a type, or I don't like you, limiting me. I'm so much more than that. And what I respond to that when they say that, because I get where they're coming from, it feels like I'm saying, oh, you're this or you're that. But the truth is, and according to this system, is, we're already in a box, because if we're not aware of what our type is and how that shows up in our lives and how we make decisions based on that, how we are in relationships based on that, then we are in a box. And some of the painful patterns that get repeated over and over are from that place. And so once we're aware what our type is, it allows us to see ourselves more objectively as a bigger picture, and we can begin to feel like we have more options in terms of how to respond. And that's why I say there's freedom that comes with this. It can feel liberating. So instead of being on autopilot, we can make a choice for how we want to behave and respond. Okay, I'm going to go through the types in a minute. And as I go through the types, here's some things for you to keep in mind. Sometimes when I explain the system, people say, oh, that one sounds like more males might be that type or more females might be that type. But it's not like that. So both males and females are all of the types. It's not gender specific that way. And a big one that I get, a really big one, is when the couples go through it, they say, well, I resonate with all of them, or I resonate with 3 of them. So I think, or they say sometimes, I think I was born a type 2 and now I moved into a type 5 or something. But the way this system is set up is that's actually not how it works. The way this system is you're born a type and you die that same type. So all through life, we're that same type. As I go through them, you might say, well, I have qualities of all. And that's true. We all have qualities of each one. So that helps, because I think we can all identify with each one. But what the theory is with this system is that there's a home base. There's one dominant or home base type that you are more often than not. So there's different levels of health within each type. There's different levels of growth. So maybe you've learned to make different choices or become a little bit healthier in within your type, but we don't change types. That's my point of that one. Also, when I ask couples to consider what their type is, I remind them to, you know, look at the one that really, really sounds like them when they review the different types, because I think sometimes we want to pick the one that we wish we were more like or the one that sounds better. But if you're reading something and you feel somehow irritated or annoyed, or you're like, oh no, I think this sounds like me, that's probably your type, because it might be mirroring some of the things that, you know, you struggle with. Okay, so we're going to dig in here, and you might want to think about your type too, because your type impacts the work you do with couples as well, so it's good to be aware. I'm just going to go 1 through 9, so I'll start with type 1. There's different labels according to different authors in terms of, you know, what they call these types. So type 1 is called the reformer or the perfectionist. And type 1's core belief is that in order to feel worthy and accepted, I must be good, I must be behaved, and I must do the right thing, avoid making mistakes, do things correctly. So a type 1 personality, they're very principled, they're responsible, they're polite, they're detail-oriented, organized, and in fact, they are skilled at making sure that things are done correctly and avoiding mistakes. They do have a strong, also a moral compass, I would call it, that tells them what's right and wrong in their life, and they hold themselves to that standard. Also, in my work, when I see a type 1 come into my office, you know, I'm not saying everybody is always this way. I'm just saying here's a tendency is that it tends to be quite important to them that their home is kept up, clean, picked up, organized, because coming home to a messy environment for them can feel stressful. So they like having their home be a retreat where things are in order and it's a place that they can relax and feel at peace. Also with this type, with type 1, if there isn't an official rule, so they're concerned with rules and following the rules and doing the right thing. And if there isn't an official rule about something, like, you know, a correct official way how to unload a dishwasher or an official system for doing laundry, you know, step 1, 2, and 3, then they're really skilled at creating a process that's the right way to do something, whatever it is. And it's right, you know, based on logic or common sense. You know, a type 1 would say something like, well, why wouldn't you do it this way? It just makes so much sense. And when you don't do it this way, then this happens, and now we got to do A, B, and C. So their focus of attention is really on that and making an efficient kind of system to work around the house. So because of that, and that's important to them, it's important that their partner be a good teammate with them that, you know, walks next to them. And when their partner isn't, when their partner runs late or doesn't, you know, oh, we should right now start getting the kids ready and my partner's still sleeping, that's something that can really irritate a type 1. So sometimes when I meet with ones, I often hear that they had a childhood with a supercritical parent or supercritical parents, where they got punished, disciplined, or made to feel like they were a bad kid when they made a mistake or when they didn't meet the standards of the parent. So they were often held at very high standards, or maybe they were the oldest in the family and they had to grow up really quick and be responsible and make sure that that everything was running smoothly. In the couples that I see where somebody identifies as a type 1, they often come in and say things like, I'm here because I'm the responsible one. I'm always the one making sure everything gets taken care of. You know, I wish my partner would step up, but then again, they probably won't do it right, so I just end up doing it myself so that I can know that it's actually done, but then I end up feeling resentful. And I've got a couple I'm working with right now where one of them identifies as a type 1, and she said, you know, why does my partner feel okay just relaxing? Why aren't they feel burdened with staying on top of things like I am? And she feels very bitter about that. And the partner of the type 1 often comes in and says, I just can't do anything right. you know, I wish my one partner would relax a little bit more. They're always criticizing me. They're judging me. Whatever I do is just not good enough, and I'm sick and tired of it. I just always feel criticized. So that's often a dynamic that I see with this, where one person identifies as a type one. And again, it's not always, but it's a common pattern. So the thing to know about a type one is they have a very strong inner critic. And they judge themselves very harshly. Now, I know we all do, regardless of our type. We all are not kind to ourselves. But supposedly, type 1's inner critic is the most severe of all the types, is what I've heard some authors say. So this same judgment, how they judge themselves, comes across. That's how they judge their partners. Working with a type 1, coming from the Enneagram, what is helpful is teaching the type one to be kinder to themselves. When they can learn to be kinder to themselves, not hold themselves to such high standards, not put so much pressure on themselves, learn how to let things go, then that translates over to their partner as well. I don't know if anybody on the call knows transactional analysis, but if you do, I would say this type has a very strong critical parent ego state, and that comes across to their partner. Also, the ability to learn how to be empathetic to their partner and realize that there's more than one right way of doing things. You know, their partner may not be doing it their way, but that way works for their partner, and can they get curious about why their partner does it this way or that way instead of going right to the judgment and right to the frustration so quickly. And then almost always, I'm helping the type one communicate their needs to their partner differently, because a type one will say, I'm always telling my partner what I want and what I need, and they just aren't doing it. But it often comes across in a way where it's hard for their partner to hear it, because sometimes it can come across like they're scolding their partner, or like I said, criticizing, and so, or how they should do things. They use the word should a lot often. So what I'm helping them do is, instead of saying, you know, partner, you didn't do this right, or you didn't do that right, I'm really trying to help the type one say something like, dear partner, you know, when you do it this way, I feel anxious and withdrawn. But when you do it that way, I feel like you care about me. I feel like I matter to you. I feel relaxed. And when they word it that way, their partner can hear them better instead of, you know, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that. Why would you do this? Why would you do that? So I help them really kind of slow down and think about how they say things and realize that how they say things impacts their partner. In terms of, I don't know if everybody on the call knows the initiator-inquirer exercise, but it's for this one, it's helpful for this type, for both roles. I mean, especially for if they're the initiator, to teach them how to say things to their partner, how to articulate what they're feeling, what they're thinking in a way that their partner can hear it. But then in the inquirer role, it's really teaching them the skill and how to manage their emotions when they're hearing what their partner is saying, and kind of managing that, the judgy thing that comes up in their head. And instead, can you put the judge aside for now and just get curious about what you hear your partner saying to you? Okay. And I'm going to move on to type two, but I thought of something important to say as well, just about this whole system in general, which is, because we are our type our whole life, we have a core belief. And so we're never, I can't say that we'll ever get rid of our core belief, but what the goal is to loosen the rigidity around the core belief. And so that's what the work is when I work with couples. Can you, number one, be aware of your personality type, your tendencies, how you are, and maybe how your family of origin influenced it? And then number two, can you loosen the rigidity? You know, can you see other options? Can you get curious? Can you manage that judge in your head? So, okay, I hope that makes sense. I'm going to move on to type two. Type two is called the giver or the helper. And the core belief with the type two is, I'm going to get my self-worth based on giving to other people, making them feel loved, and being helpful. So these are people persons. Relationships are very important to this type. They're very skilled at anticipating people's needs, doing favors for them, being a good friend, instilling confidence in other people, complimenting them. People tend to be drawn to type twos for this reason. It's kind of like it just feels good being around them. They make me feel so good. They're friendly. They're charming. It's important that they're liked. They do want to be liked and approved of. And a type two will say, you know, I can get along with just about any personality. And they're kind of proud of that. You know, they like that because relationships are important. Getting along, connecting with people is important. So they put a lot of energy into other people, making sure people are comfortable. Now, at the same time, a type two tends to not voice their own needs. So their attention is on other people's needs, making sure they're okay. But me, no, I'm fine. And there's a reluctance and avoidance to mentioning what their own needs might be. And they may even deny it to themselves and deny it to other people. What I often hear a type 2 say, I've heard this so many times now, is they'll say, well, if I ask for what I need, even if I can get them to admit they have a need, they'll say, well, I feel selfish or guilty. And I see that show up in certain ways, like maybe they'll ask for something and then they'll kind of backpedal and say, no, never mind, you know, I don't need that after all. And so I really help them hold them to that and say, wait a minute, you know, what's going on for you right now? Oh, I feel selfish or guilty. And then we can work that through and have their partner talk to them about that and give themselves permission to ask for what they need. But because they have this reluctance or this feeling guilt when they ask for something, they're in a bit of a bind. Because, especially when they're in a relationship, because they do have needs, they're human. But so even if they're not connected to what they are, they have needs. But how do they get them met? Because they're afraid to ask for them. So what tends to happen with this type, and if they don't know their Enneagram type, it's often a subconscious kind of unspoken contract that they have with others, which is, hey, I'll be very helpful and I'll be very giving to you, dear partner, and then you just do the same back to me without me asking for anything, without me telling you what I need. Just do it back to me because I'm being proactive, I'm taking the initiative, and if I do that, surely you'll do the same thing back, and then I won't have to ask anything from you, and then we'll both be good and we'll both get our needs met. So that's the hope in the type 2's mind. However, unfortunately, it doesn't always work out that way. So 2's, sometimes they're givers to the point of exhaustion. And then when it doesn't get reciprocated or it's unappreciated or not acknowledged, they can feel resentful. So they do enjoy giving, though. You know, they get a lot out of it. It makes them feel good. They love giving to their partner that they love so much. But they also appreciate just they feel connected when their partner appreciates them for it and acknowledges it as well. It's a major source of feeling love for them. When I work with couples where somebody identifies as a type 2, sometimes I hear that growing up in their family of origin, they had a caretaking role. Maybe one parent was an alcoholic or one parent was depressed. And so the two really had the role of making sure everybody was okay. Or maybe one parent was unstable or not safe. So the type two child really had to accommodate the parent in order to keep peace. And so they learn to suppress their needs to get by and to make sure that, you know, the person that they love is taken care of. So they have that focus of attention always on the other person. So in relationships, they do tend to see the best in people, and they tend to believe that, you know, with a little bit of encouragement and support, they can influence the other person to change for the better. And sometimes because of that, they find themselves in relationships that maybe aren't so healthy or don't work so well, that they maybe wish they would have gotten out of a long time ago, but they're optimistic, and they just think, no, if I give my love to this person and I help them, I can really transform them. And sometimes it can be disappointing and exhausting to be in that role. And also they can, you know, overextend themselves. When I work with couples of this type, I am usually helping them with focusing on themselves a little bit more. So with the initiator-inquirer exercise, for example, they tend to do a pretty good job of being the inquirer, you know, of really listening to where their partner's coming from. And something that I'm often helping them with is doing the initiator role, where they're really speaking about, you know, where they're coming from and what their needs are and what matters to them and what's important to them. Also, here's another example I wanted to give you. A couple very recently came in, and very, very suddenly, she said, "I want a divorce." And he said, "I'm shocked. I had no idea that you want a divorce." And she said, "How could you not know? I've been miserable for years." He said, "Oh, I had no idea." So she identified as a type 2. And what had happened was she just spent the whole relationship accommodating, and didn't tell him that she was accommodating until finally she flipped over on the other side and said, I'm done. And there really wasn't a middle part about, you know, I feel like I'm accommodating all the time and this isn't working for me. Can we talk about this? There wasn't that piece that existed. So that's another way that that kind of system can show up in a relationship. Okay. Type 3. Type 3 is sometimes called the achiever. And their core belief is that in order to be loved and accepted and in accordance with their accomplishments and how successful they feel, they must avoid failure. So it's important for this type to feel successful, to feel like they're not failing to do well. Their self-worth tends to be based on what they do. So what I've heard about this type is they're often human doers instead of human beings, because doing is just so high on their list of priorities, getting things done. They're very driven. They are tend to be charismatic. They're skilled at setting and reaching goals. And so while a type 1 wants to get the job done correctly, the type 3 is more concerned about getting it done efficiently and quickly so that they can move on. They tend to feel impatient if somebody meanders. They kind of just want to get to the point. Productivity is important to them. They often have a checklist of things they want to get done. They feel that they receive love and affection based on their image, their achievements, their performance, and sometimes this type can identify more with an image about who they are rather than who they actually are inside. Based on an image about how they would like people to see them, sometimes that can happen. But they want to be the best at whatever they do. Sometimes this type can say, you know, if I'm going to do something, I just really want to do it best. So they can be kind of competitive about things. And also, sometimes when I'm wondering, are they this type or that type, I'll ask them a distinguishing question, which is, you know, if you did something well and nobody noticed, would that be okay with you? Or is it really important that somebody notices? Do you feel really, really good when somebody notices you do something well? And this type would say, yeah, that I really, you know, if I'm being honest with you, I really want somebody to notice when I do things well. And that tends to boost their self-esteem. In terms of the childhood, what I often hear from somebody who identifies as a type 3 is that it was important when I was growing up, it was important to one of my parents that I did well. So, for example, you know, one parent, you know, it meant a lot to that parent for the child to be really good at sports, because that reflected on that parent. And another example I remember is somebody said, well, my brother was always messing up and always upsetting my parents, so I wanted to, you know, contain the conflict by just doing well and not being a problem. I did well in school. I excelled in sports. You know, I was the best on the team. I was the kid who didn't cause any problems. So that's how I've seen it show up sometimes in their family of origin. In couples work, what I see a lot is somebody with a type 3 comes in and they're overworked. They're overwhelmed with everything they have to do. Not all the time. I mean, but sometimes the partner says, my partner's working too much, they're never home. And the other person says, I'm not working too much, or I have a lot to do. And they don't believe it's a problem. But in one couple, one of the partners said, you know, I want to talk about our relationship, but I just don't have the time to do it. I want to talk to you about our problems and where we're stuck, but I just don't have the time. To which, you know, he heard that and he thought it was a cop-out. He said, what do you mean you don't have time? Of course you have time and you're just trying to avoid it. And then, you know, she started crying, and she really explained how much pressure she's putting on herself to do everything around the house, to do her job, to take care of this and that, finishing all her tasks every day, only to the next day have another long list of things to do. So the partner of a type 3 can sometimes feel like they're being put on the back burner while their partner's just doing so much and not as much making their relationship a priority. A type 3, from what I've seen too, they tend to be sensitive to criticism from their partner because it can feel like they're failing in their relationship or letting their partner down in some way, and so they're sensitive about that sense of failing. So for the work for someone who identifies with this type is to help them slow down. I mean, some of them even tend to talk really fast when they come in, and they're very solution goal oriented. They just kind of want to know, you know, tell me what to do and how do we get through this? Not only in life, but sometimes in communicating with their partner. So when I teach them the initiator inquire exercise, sometimes I think they can get a little impatient with it because, you know, they just want to know what to do. But that's exactly what they need to do, though, is kind of slow down, get in touch with their feelings. A type 3 is sometimes out of touch with how they feel because there's this sense of, if I get in touch with how I feel and I connect with it, it just slows me down, especially if it's a negative feeling. So I'm just going to power through it, and I'm just going to go, and I'm going to get done what I need to get done. But part of the work is, like I said, to slow down, have them connect with themselves. Sometimes they're not able to articulate their feelings to their partner for that reason. Their partner feels disconnected from them. So homework assignments I give to this type sometimes is I'll tell them two things. Number one, set an alarm on your phone 3 times a day. When the alarm goes off on your phone, go inside, connect with yourself, and consider what you're feeling in that moment. What are you feeling? What are you thinking, and why? And see if you can connect with your heart from that place. And then the other thing I ask them to do is take more time for themselves and maybe with their partner too. So like they have to kind of trick themselves, which they're always, you know, they get satisfaction by putting things on a list or on their calendar. And I say, you know, why don't you add time with your partner to your list or time to yourself on your list of things to get done. Okay, so let's move on to type 4. Type 4 is called the individualist or the tragic romantic, I've heard it called. The core belief of a type 4 is that they must attain the longed for idealistic relationship or situation in order to be loved. There's a feeling with 4s that something's missing in life. They have a sadness to them. It's almost like they're longing for something that they don't have, and they can look to other people like, how come that person has, they're happy? Why are they confident? How come they achieve that? So there can be this passing, fleeting thought of envy. It's like, and that there can also be this grass is greener feeling. Like, I'm missing or lacking, you know, if only I had that job or only I had that relationship. And then sometimes they find that when they do that thing, when they get to that relationship, when they get to that job, it's not what they thought it was. And how can I still feel empty? Why do I still feel sad? And then they're kind of looking off to the next thing. Sometimes it can show up that way. And it's like, if only I could do this or that, I'd finally feel whole. They're very creative people. They tend to be very intuitive, very perceptive. They tend to be able to read their partner easily, read other people easily. They're very skilled at that. So that's a sensitivity that is a plus. And then there's also a sensitivity where they tend to be super sensitive to criticism. Like if their partner gives them feedback about something, they can sometimes pull it in and internalize it like a sponge. And then it's hard for them to get back out of it. So they're, like I said, they have a great sense of humor. They like thoughtful conversations. They're compassionate. They tend to be very self-aware. Being authentic to them, finding who they are inside and coming from that place is very important to them. They tend to have a very rich inner world, which they often express through, you know, being creative outlets. And sometimes they'll say, you know, I have a rich inner world and I feel like other people just don't get me. They don't understand it. They don't, you know, and then they can feel like an outsider. Type 4s often report having a childhood that feels sad. So either they didn't feel loved or responded to in some way. Maybe there was an early death in the family, so they felt that early loss. But whatever experience, it kind of, their childhood tends to have some heaviness to it or a sadness there. They weren't, you know, they didn't have the kind of care that they should have had or that they wanted to have, that they longed for. So when I work with couples who identify with this type, they often say things like, I know I'm too sensitive, but, you know, here's what my partner did. And oftentimes their partner feels like they're walking on eggshells. But with this type, since their focus of attention is often on what's missing, they can struggle for appreciating the good qualities their partners have. And so I'm often in this session saying, you know, what do you notice that's good about what your partner is doing? What are their good qualities? What are you noticing? How are they responding to you that makes you feel good? Because I know that the attention of this type can often go to what's missing, and then there's a sadness there. This type can also be self-absorbed, and what I mean by that is that they're very acutely aware of how they feel and how their partner has hurt them, and they can become really stuck on that. Their feelings are very intense, and they identify with their feelings. So I'm helping them two things there. Number one is realizing that you are not necessarily your feelings, because you feel, you know, hurt, you're validated in that, but it doesn't mean that your partner is a really, really bad person. Let's see if we can get curious about where they were coming from at the same time, and we're not justifying it, we're not condoning it, but I'm really trying to help make room in them about, you know, where their partner's coming from. Can they get curious about their partner? So for their initiator inquirer exercise, it's more important. I work with them a lot around being a really good inquirer and seeing if they can delve in, and I'm helping them manage the emotions that come up when their partner, you know, is starting to speak their truth to them. And, you know, I'm not sure if this is the right word, but resilience, I'm helping them manage their emotions a little bit better. This type tends to kind of spill over with their emotions, and because they can feel so overwhelmed with hurt or shame or guilt or feeling, you know, like their partner was attacking them. So I'm helping them, you know, put both feet flat on the ground and tapping their knees, which helps ground them sometimes, get from emotion to their thinking brain. Okay, type 5 is called the observer. And for type 5, the core belief is that the world is overwhelming and demanding and that they need to protect themselves from that. So they often will retreat into their mind. They like to spend plenty of time alone. And, you know, social events can be stressful and overwhelming. They tend to not enjoy social events for that reason, where there's a lot of people, there's mingling. Type 5s like to have real conversations about topics of substance that are interesting. They don't really like chitty chat where it feels superficial. They get uncomfortable with that. But they just tend to like one-on-one conversations around an interesting topic that they are knowledgeable about, that they've learned about, they're knowledgeable about, that they're comfortable talking about. So they do want to connect with others, but at the same time, sometimes that can feel overwhelming to them. And sometimes I hear them say they feel inadequate socially. So they retreat. These types retreat into their intellect. They're very sharp thinkers. They're excellent debaters. They tend to be experts on different topics. You know, they like to read. And sometimes their self-worth can come from the level of knowledge that they have on something. They also, I hear them say too, that they don't need a lot of comforts in life. You know, they don't need a lot of stuff. Often goes along with this type. They tend to know what they think, but not what they feel. Sometimes feelings can be overwhelming for this type. And if you remember, I just talked about threes not that long ago. They avoid feelings. Threes avoid feelings because it gets in the way of reaching their goals. But fives avoid feelings because feelings overwhelm them. And it's almost like they feel like they could be overtaken by them. And so they're more comfortable saying what they think. about something, which is the opposite of fours. Fours are very big feelers. They know what they feel. But fives are more into thinking. The fives are very respectful. They're intelligent. They're non-demanding. They're unobtrusive. They're thoughtful, logical people. Fives, sometimes with their upbringing in their childhoods, they'll report saying, you know, I had an overbearing parent, or I had a parent that crossed boundaries, or I had a parent that didn't respect my personal space or felt invasive in some way. And so learning how to manage that when they were growing up was to kind of just retreat and withdraw. When I work with couples where one person's a five, I find myself just as a therapist in my chair really pulling back my energy. And I'm being mindful about giving them their personal space, not coming across too strongly. I think with this type, it can sometimes feel like they're being interrogated just when I'm asking them questions to get to know them better. Even that can feel intrusive, like I'm coming in on their space and I'm just trying to dig into them. So I'm trying to be really gentle and pull back when I know somebody is a type five, and I just try to pull my energy back a lot. And I'm also helping them identify their feelings, too, and talk about their feelings. And if they say they don't know what they feel, I might work with them on that or give them a feelings chart. And overall, it gets better and better. I have a couple that has come such a long way where he was a type 5 and when they first came in. And so he was a 5 and she was a 2. So you can imagine, she's a relationship person. I want to connect with you. I want to know what you feel. And then I want to talk about our relationship. And he was more of a head type, an intellect, a logical. So he wasn't connected with his feelings, and they were really missing each other there. But he grew so much in terms of learning how to go to connect with his heart, is what he says, and to articulate where he's coming from and to set boundaries when he needs to. It's just incredible the work that they've done together. A type 5 doesn't often ask for much. Because if they ask, the other person gives. Now they feel like they have this thing going where they owe each other something, and they open themselves up to be taken from endlessly. There's this fear that they're just going to be, you know, that they're just going to run out of energy. So they tend to withdraw and not ask for things. I think I said before, they have a difficult time setting boundaries as well, and they withdraw to protect their space. I don't often see a 5 initiate therapy. Usually when a couple comes in, the partner brought in the 5. And the 5 is usually there saying, you know, I'm here because my partner wanted me to come. And it takes some work to find out what could be the objectives for the 5 being in therapy. But when I work with them, when I'm gentle, pull back my energy, they do come forward and say what's important to them and why they're there, but also learning to identify what their needs are. So that's part of it as well. Okay, so type 6 is the questioner or the loyal skeptic. The core belief of the type 6 is that the world is dangerous, and they seek to feel safe. They're concerned with finding safety and security. They tend to be vigilant people. They're very observant. If I'm in a restaurant with a type 6, they tend to know who's behind them, who's next to them, who's everywhere. They're doubtful people. Sometimes they second-guess themselves a lot. They have anxiety, and sometimes they don't know they have a lot of anxiety, just generalized anxiety in life. It's almost like a fish in water, where the fish is just in water so long that they don't know that they're in water. It can be that way with a type 6. I've met a lot of people identify as type 6 where I've asked them if they have anxiety in life, and they say no, but then once they learned the Enneagram and once they learned to kind of check in with themselves, they go, you know what, I do live with anxiety that's kind of there all the time. So they may focus excessively on what could go wrong in a situation. Sometimes they're worst-case scenario thinkers. They also need to know who's on my side, who isn't. Sometimes they have a we versus they type scenario running through their head. The family tends to be really important for this type. Loyalty to people that you love. They're really there for people in their tribe or in their family. It's like they would drop everything to be there for people. So they have that sense of loyalty. They often want to be contributing citizens. I've noticed police officers and people in the military, there's a lot of sixes there. I've noticed they're hard workers, they're friendly, thoughtful. As children, sometimes they've reported that there was something that wasn't secure about it. You know, maybe they had a parent that was overly fearful about things. Somehow they got a message that life wasn't safe. Maybe there was an early divorce where things kind of fell apart and they felt like their foundation wasn't there that really impacted them strongly as an example. So in couples work, it's really interesting because trust is so important with this type because of their core beliefs. Often, but not always, of course, there's an issue with trust when these couples come in. It's often but not always, where this type doesn't trust their partner in some way. You know, recently I was working with a couple. She walked into his office, and he was on his laptop. And he was on a UPS site, so I think he was ordering some stamps or something. But she walked into the office, and she'd never seen him on a UPS site before. So immediately what her reflex is in terms of what she thought was that surely her husband's cheating on her, and she's sending, and he's on UPS sending a gift to his mistress. So when I asked her about that, she said, well, no, I really don't think he'd cheat on me. That's just the first thing that popped in my head, and I accuse him of it. There's no history of affairs or anything like that, but that's where her attention went first, just as an example. Sometimes because they can be worst-case scenario thinkers, part of what I help them do is to see the positive, to see the progress they've made in their couple's work, and to see, you know, the optimism and what's good about things. And oftentimes partners say, like, gosh, you're just talking about the negative things, like, what's positive here between us? And something that's helpful for people in a relationship with a type six is to say, you know, before you tell me what you're about to say, can you start with something positive? And that really helps with the connection between the two people. When I work with these people and when one partner assumes something about their partner, it can sometimes come across as an accusation. And so what I ask that partner to do is to check it out with them and say, you know, instead of assuming this about your partner, can you ask them if this is true? Because sometimes there's a grain of truth in what they're thinking about their partner, but then it tends to be over-exaggerated. So it's almost like an inner alarm goes off in their mind and like something bad is happening, and so therefore there must really be something bad happening. So I'm helping them develop a healthy filter and checking out what's in their mind, because sometimes this type, personality type, they can't tell the difference between, you know, am I being very observant or am I being paranoid here? And they can't tell the difference between the two. And I'll say that to them. You know, I think sometimes here's what's going on, and they agree with that. Okay, the next one is type 7, and this one's called the adventurer. So their core belief of the type 7 is that you must keep your options open and avoid pain to enjoy life. So they like to keep sight of possibilities in life. They have an active imagination. They're the ultimate pleasure seekers, really. They're out to have fun. They like to keep things light. When they organize their life around this belief, you see someone who's curious. They're eager for new ideas. They're easily stimulated. They come up with lots of exciting possibilities. Their wheels are always turning. They don't like situations that are limiting, boring, painful, and sometimes that means even, you know, oh, I can't go to this event. I have to stay home and watch the kids. And not saying that they don't enjoy spending time with their kids at all, but it can sometimes feel like, oh, I can't do this fun thing because I have to do this instead kind of thing. Or doing menial tasks or paperwork can sometimes feel painful because it's too boring. But planning an activity where there's some stimulation around it feels invigorating, and they love planning it. But then sometimes when it comes to following through in the plan, it can lose its juice actually doing it. They're very future-oriented, and sometimes they start more projects than they can actually finish. but they're very creative. They tend to be outgoing. They like to make people laugh. I think Robin Williams was a 7, for example. So you have an example there. Some childhood reports of this type I hear is maybe there wasn't some nurturing in some way, or they felt deprived in some way. So then the way they handled that was to do different things to distract themselves, to minimize any pain they feel or anxiety they were experiencing. This type tends to have a tendency to avoid talking about things in the relationship that are heavy, sad. Sometimes they're overly optimistic, which is great because sometimes a couple comes in where one person's a 7 and they start out saying everything that's going great in the relationship, and that's wonderful, of course. And it's different with this type because sometimes I'm having to say, you know, it's great, there's all these positive things, and how's this going and how is that going? So I'm the one bringing up sometimes with this type some things that maybe they don't really want to look at. I'm also helping them with the initiator inquirer exercise, for example, to be a really good inquirer in terms of really, really get where their partner's coming from. This type can sometimes be focused on themselves as well in terms of what their interests are and what they want. And it just sometimes can be a natural tendency where they don't always consider their partner in ways that their partner wishes that they would. I had one couple where they were on a road trip to a cabin or something like that, and she said all my husband could think about while we were driving to our cabin was how we wanted to be surfing instead. And so we were in a car going to the cabin. It was exciting for the family, but then my husband wasn't present. He was thinking about something else. So something else I'm working with this type is to help them be more present emotionally. Okay. So type 8, this is the protector, the challenger, the boss. Their core belief is that people would take advantage of me if I let them. So I better protect my vulnerability. I better be strong. I better be powerful. 8s usually know what they think. They know their opinions. They tend to be confrontational. They're blunt. They're strong. They're decisive. They don't enjoy fighting per se, but they're not afraid to be confrontational and confront people. They don't really have a problem disagreeing with people. They tend to be good leaders. Sometimes if I'm not sure somebody's a type 8, I ask them, have you ever been accused of plowing people over, or have you ever been accused of coming across too harshly? And then if they say yes, I mean, there's other types that can, of course, be that. But that's a really good question to ask somebody if you're not sure if they're a type 8. Sometimes when people say to them, you know, you came across too strongly, you really hurt my feelings, a type 8 might have one of two responses. They might say, you know, oh, I didn't know, and I'm going to try to pull back my energy. But they could also say something like, well, you know, you need to just toughen up. You know, you can't be so weak. What I'm saying is true, and I'm just trying to solve the problem and go forward. How can we do it if you can't even hear the truth? Something like that. But they're concerned with truth, justice, fairness, and if they've been wronged by something, they really want to do something about it. They can be kind of intense personalities. They don't like beating around the bush at all. You know, they want to just get to the core of things. Childhoods, I'm thinking of a handful of 8s right now reporting of tough upbringing where in some way it wasn't safe to be vulnerable. It wasn't safe to show their feelings or needs. There just wasn't room for it. It wasn't welcome. It wasn't safe. So they learned they had to protect themselves. It wasn't safe to be vulnerable. They do have a soft teddy bear inside, but it's like they have a hard external shell. It can feel that way to people, but a soft little teddy bear that they don't show to many people because the belief is people will take advantage of you if you let them. So they protect their vulnerability. So you can imagine, you know, I'm describing this type, what some of the dynamics might be that come up. Now, for example, if you've got somebody who's a type 4, so that one's the big feeler and they're a little bit more sensitive, paired up in a relationship with somebody who's an 8, who's a little bit more confrontational and direct, I'm thinking about a few couples now, and the pattern was where when they communicated, you know, the 4 was the 8 was just too direct and felt mean to the type 4. So I'm giving you that example because after a while you can kind of see what kind of patterns might come up with the two types and what the work is. And again, I'm saying that it's not always that way, but you can start to see patterns. So with the eight, I'm helping them soften up. Can you say that in a way your partner can hear you better? Can you soften up a little bit? Can you get beneath, if you're angry or if you're annoyed, can you get beneath it and talk about, are you hurt? Are you afraid? And can you actually say that to your partner? That's not always easy for an eight. Sometimes they have a hard time apologizing because that can feel kind of weak and vulnerable. So I'm helping them do that, soften up your vulnerability. Their eights are very, very concerned with what's the truth. So I'm helping them know that their partners, see what their partner's differences are, and knowing that there's more than one truth. You know, there's how you see it and how you do things, but there's also your partner who has a different makeup than you do. And, you know, they're not, maybe they don't have the kind of resilience you do, and so they're a little bit more sensitive than you are. So can you work with that? Can you lower your voice when they ask you to? You know, like all types, eights are wonderful people. They're protective. Oftentimes, they're just trying to help their partner, or they're just trying to protect themselves. And so, you know, if their partner feels bossed around or something, it's helpful for the eight to pull back their energy and to get curious about their partner's reality. Okay, we're going to do type 9, and then I will stop for questions. Okay, type 9 is the peacemaker. And their core belief is that in order to be loved, I must be compliant, and I must merge with my partner and blend in with others. So these are people that are seekers of harmony and seekers of peace. They want to avoid conflict. They just want peace at all costs. They're not that in touch with their anger. In fact, they would say, you know, I don't really get angry that often. It takes a lot to really make me mad. Someone like this is often described as a really nice person, and you get the sense that you can tell them anything and they won't judge you. So they really give a nice gift in life of being their friend. They're often very non-judgmental, accepting. They just want to get along with people. They're genuine. Some of them like routine. They don't like change because that kind of interferes with their homeostasis and feeling the kind of peace they want to have. A lot of them are fine having the same job or living in the same house for years and not changing it. Sometimes they can get attached to clothes and furniture and things like that. But they tend to merge with people that they're in relationship with. And that means they focus on, well, what do you want? You know, where do you want to go eat? Well, I don't really care. Where do you want to go? Tends to be their default response. So they don't often look inside themselves about, you know, where am I coming from? And even if they do, they might try to find a way for them to, it's intimidating for them to put out there where they're coming from. And so an example is a couple I'm working with where the nine is very afraid of his partner and just afraid to say, like, hey, that's not okay with me. But he's really just trying to orient himself so that she's okay, so that there's peace. But it's contradictory because in the effort to keep peace, sweep things under the rug, avoid conflict, it creates conflict because everything just gets piled up. It all goes under the rug and it sits there and festers. So the work with, oh, and so let me talk about the childhood first and then I'll talk about the work. In childhood, the nine often reports feeling invisible or overlooked, feeling unimportant. They just felt like they were not acknowledged or seen or taken into account. So that's a painful thing for them as an adult as well, if they're feeling that way with their partner. The work for a type 9 when I work with them is sometimes they tell me they don't know what they think and they don't know what they feel. Sometimes they do. But it's helping them say, what do you think and what do you feel? Number one, step one. And step two, can you articulate that to your partner? And if that causes upset to your partner in some way, can you hold that tension? Can you hold that anxiety and hold on to yourself in that moment and not just merge with them and give in to keep the peace? You know, can you self-define? Let me see if there's anything else I wanted to say about the type 9 before I open up the lines. Some of the frustrating things I see with when somebody comes in when one partner's a type 9 is, you know, my 9 partner says that they're going to do A, B, or C, and then they don't do it. They don't follow through. 9s sometimes struggle with procrastinating with things and or agreeing to do something just to keep peace. but then they don't say their part about why they don't want to do it. They'll just say, yes, I'll do it, but then they don't. So, of course, the work there is when their partner says, you know, I think we should discipline our daughter this way, and the nine says, yeah, sounds good, I will look at the nine and say, can you articulate to me about why you individually think that's a good reason to discipline your daughter in that way? So that they can, instead of just automatically agreeing with their partner, they can go inside themselves and connect and figure out where they're coming from and how they want to discipline their daughter, et cetera, just as an example. Okay, so in that case, I think we'll say goodbye to everybody.
Michelle, thanks for being here today. Great
thank
job.
You awesome
thank you.
Good. You're very welcome. Thanks for being on, everybody.
Thanks for being here, you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thank you. Very interesting.
Okay. Good. Glad you enjoyed it. Bye, everybody.